I'm taking over today. I'm with Kim's. We are here in downtown Cincinnati, Thompson Hine. It's such a pleasure to be with this amazing group of women. Rosie Park is here to tell her story of how her family-owned business was recently sold, how that business was started. And Holly and I were fortunate enough to be on her team and her family's team in that successful exit. And then Aaron got involved with a donation. So we're all going to talk about our roles in that and being women in business.
Future is now. Broadcasting from the Queen City, breaking down business, leadership, community, and family. Here's your host, the president and CEO of the Northern Cincinnati Foundation, Aaron Satzker.
Today we are here coming to you from downtown Cincinnati at Thompson Hine. We have three amazing powerhouse ladies today that we are bringing on the What Gives podcast. And I've honestly been just so excited about bringing on these three ladies. So what we're going to do is we're going to have them introduce themselves today.
Hi, I'm Rosie Park. I grew up in Cincinnati. My parents came as immigrants to Cincinnati in the early 70s. And I currently work for Tedia Company, and it is a chemical manufacturing company, and I'm the VP of Legal and Culture there.
Hi, my name is Emma Off. I am also a Cincinnati native. I am a partner at Thompson Hine, which is a full-service law firm. We have an office in Cincinnati, but also offices all across the country. I specialize in mergers and acquisitions and help companies like Tedia and other businesses and private equity companies buy and sell businesses.
Hi, I'm Holly Mazzocca. I'm the president of Bartlett Wealth Management. I grew up across the river in northern Kentucky and came back to Cincinnati in 2015. I'm now the president of Bartlett Wealth Management, and Bartlett focuses on serving individuals and nonprofit organizations to meet all of their wealth goals. One of my favorite areas of focus is on women in finance. We recently launched We Invest, Women Empowered to Invest, which is a community geared towards helping women go deeper with their finances, ask the hard questions, and engage in conversations of meaning around their wealth.
Well, I just have to say that it's funny that in a way we all knew one another, but didn't know we all knew one another. And so I'm just excited that we're all brought together in the same room today. I want to dive into Tedia Company and Rosie, your story, your family's story, and if you could share that with our audience today and kind of how it was birthed and where you are today.
Sure. So my parents emigrated from Korea. In fact, they were not married, but they met here and got married here in the United States. And they were both getting their educations here. At that time in Korea, the higher educational system was just kind of non-existent. There were very few opportunities. And so during that time, a lot of immigrants from Korea came to the United States to study. So my mom studied nursing and my dad studied chemistry and chemical engineering. And he'd always wanted to start his own business. So he came to Cincinnati. They moved here to pursue his PhD. But then he ended up getting a job and working and then leaving that place to go start his own chemical manufacturing company. And the company sells solvents, which at
Rosie,
that time...
Rosie, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
How did he seed the capital he needed to start that business? I don't think I've ever asked you that.
That's a really good question.
Oh, my goodness. So the way they started the business then, you would never, ever be able to start a business like that now. Not a chemical manufacturing business, certainly. They just saved up one of their salaries for a couple of years. And I think they borrowed a little bit of money from their families and started this chemical manufacturing company.
Wow.
And in fact, like one of the most expensive analytical instruments that you use to test the products was donated to them by a customer. And the customer didn't even ask them to pay back. They're like, oh, when you're finished using it, just send it back to us, which of course they didn't expect. But it was a major chemical company that we still work with today. Which is amazing. But they saw the value and they wanted to support my dad because they knew that he had so much technical knowledge. And at that time, solvents were so important. They were just coming up into the market because that's when in the 70s, environmental testing became so so prominent. It wasn't an important thing to do before, but Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, if you know that book, just raised people's awareness about the importance of these chemicals, these harmful things in our environment. And so high purity solvents are the things that you use to test for the presence of those harmful chemicals. And that's what the market demanded. And my dad saw that demand, and so he started this company. So, of course, you know, the two of them, they did everything for the longest time. I mean, they were labeling, they were filling the bottles with chemicals, and they were putting the bottles in the boxes and sealing the boxes and stacking them. And, you know, my dad did all the technical stuff. My mom did all the, like, the purchasing and kept the books and whatever, and they just like miraculously grew the business from there.
Did you, as a child, were you helping in the family business?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Were there. My sister is 3 years younger than I am, and the two of us would constantly be hanging out in the office. We called it the office, but it was a plant. And, you know, I'm sure they were violating all kinds of, you know, laws, exposing us to all these chemicals and things. But we would just, like, really, literally roller skate in the warehouse. You know, we just had these plastic roller skates and would skate back and forth, or we'd play with whatever. And then as we got older, they actually did put us to work. And so we were actually labeling the bottles with chemicals. I mean, these are 17-pound bottles, and we were, like, struggling to, you know, get them in the boxes and whatever. But, I mean, it was fun for us. We just kind of did it.
You never resented that business, you know, took away your parents and...
That is a very good point. I think we didn't resent it until later. As we got older, you know, there were times when we wouldn't see them for days. Like, we were in high school maybe or middle school. And we were old enough to sort of get ourselves out the door and come back home. But we wouldn't see them for days because they would be up and out before we, you know, went to school, and they'd come home. And because they had to do everything, like, my dad was literally, like, making sure that the quality of the chemical was where it needed to be. And so he was waiting for the test, for the batch to be done. Then he had to inject the chemical into the instrument and get the results. And if something went wrong, he had to be there to fix it. So, yeah, it did. And all they did was talk about Tedia at the dinner table. And, you know, my sister and I, you know, we did resent it. And you know, there were certainly times when, you know, we had a sporting event or a performance or something, and they couldn't always make it because they had something going on at the business. We couldn't leave town to go on vacations because they had to be there to run the business. Sure. So the longest we were ever gone was like a weekend. So
Yeah,
it was really challenging. And I grew up being resentful of that business, so that when people would ask me what I wanted to do when I grew up, like, do you want to work at Tedia? I'm like, no way. No way, because I was like, there's no way. I'm going to keep myself as far away from that as I possibly can. And of course, I ended up...
But you did go away.
I did go away, yes, yeah. Yes.
Can you tell that story about, okay, so, you know, obviously you graduated, right, and you tried your hat at something else, right? Very successfully, I thought.
Can you
talk about that?
So I went to school, to college in Chicago, and then ended up going to Georgia to hang out with my then boyfriend and fiance, and later on current husband. Then we decided to go to graduate school, to the same school. So I went to get my JD MPA, and he went to get his creative writing degree. And then we left there, graduated from IU Bloomington, and then went to Athens, Georgia. And so we were there for about 4 years. He was working at the University of Georgia. I was working for the local government there, doing policy work and, running economic development programs. And then my mom called us one day. She called and said, you know, do you want to join the business? Because if you don't, I need to make plans. I'm getting offers to buy the company. And when I thought about it, even as much as I resented Tedia, I couldn't let that leave our family. It was the connection. Well, my father passed away when I was a senior in high school. And so that was a very important connection to my father and to his legacy. And I couldn't let the company leave the family. So the company was started in 1975, and then we joined in 2003. And to that point, when we joined Tedia, I think the revenue was maybe $6 million, and we had maybe 45 employees. Okay. And now we have about 110 employees and close to $45 million in revenue. So I would say that from the time we joined, it grew very rapidly. Actually, we had the right kinds of things we were doing, and the market was really such that the company, we benefited from that, and I think we had the right team in place that we were able to grow the company pretty steadily over time. And then there was a time when it wasn't so great. We had some sort of black swan events in 2018, some of them internal, you know, bad decisions, some of them external market related things that we were suddenly very, very frightened that we could lose the business. And that's when we decided to sell. The ownership group, we realized how much at risk we were because we could not fund, we couldn't further fund the company to grow. And also, if these black swan events occurred again, we weren't sure that we were going to be able to bail Tedia out because all of us, all the owners, had all their eggs in that basket. We don't have wealth outside of Tedia. Sure. It's all in Tedia.
Right.
And so, and also we weren't also necessarily large enough to be able to get the kind of funding from banks and the support that we needed in order to really grow and take advantage of some of the opportunities that we knew were out there.
So can we talk about this part of that conversation? And I'm going to bring in Emma and Holly really into that conversation. But Emma, from a mergers and acquisitions standpoint, working with clients, you know, like Tedia, where do you come in and play a role in that situation?
So I remember very well my first meeting with Rosie because we represented Tedia on their very successful exit. And a partner of mine who has known Rosie and her family for a long time asked if I would lead as an M&A specialist this transaction. And for me, I take it so seriously because both of my parents are business owners, and I've seen the sweat and the worry and the late nights of, you know, that business owners go through. I mean, you can have a lot of success, but everything's riding on your back, you know? And so when I help people, especially family owned, you know, that means a lot to me. I mean, you really have to trust me. So I came into the meeting, it was Rosie and it was another owner. And, you know, I think that it was a good, you know, connection, but trust has to be built, you know, like it's not just that first meeting. You could say, oh, I've done this, I've done that. And it's all true. But, I think that there needs to be a little bit of a relationship and that is, you know, grows. And we had a great first meeting and Paul said, this is who's going to be, you know, leading the deal.
Yeah.
And,
but I also looked at Emma and I was like, she looks really young. I believe that she had all the experience, and I trusted Paul to hand us over to someone who knew what they were doing.
Right.
But at the same time, I was like, okay, we'll wait and see about this.
Yeah, I don't blame you. And it's funny because I've had clients where partners will do this. You know, it will be, you know, okay, I'm going to hand you off to Emma to do the deal, and they take time to, like, you know, they're not sure.
Sure.
What kind of?
It makes sense.
For sure.
Yeah. This is your baby.
This is
your baby.
Yeah.
So we were brought in at that point. They were Baird was representing them, mm-hmm. In the market to sell the business. Great team there.
Mm-hmm.
Leo Witt and Chris Johnson, who I loved working with. And so we were brought in as lawyers at exactly the right time, which is as early as possible, so we could work with the bankers. When you're in the market, and that's really when we were brought in on the deal piece. But like I said, our firm had represented Tedia
for a long time
before that. And
that's
so had
right.
a very long standing relationship with the business.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Holly on the business front and working with Tedia.
Yeah.
How did that conversation go for you? I kind of like to hear the puzzle, you know what I mean? And how this all fits together.
I think that's a really good point, Erin, on the team. And I do think that that's something that is sometimes underestimated, is the power of having the diverse perspectives and pulling in help at different periods of time. And I think, Rosie, you bring up such a good point on, hey, all of our eggs were in this Tedia basket and all of our wealth was in the Tedia basket. And a lot of times what we see at Bartlett is that's exactly the way business owners think, and it's exactly the way that they run their business. And so all too often they say, well, I can't have
a wealth advisor yet. I don't have anything. I don't have any wealth to give a wealth advisor. So we had the great fortune of being introduced through Gene Lauterbach, who is both of our Vistage coaches. And for those who are unfamiliar with Vistage, I recently had someone tell me that it was like camp for CEOs. And I think that's about right. It's a day where you come together with other business leaders in your roundtable to really dive into the projects and the concerns that are in your business. It's a day to work in the, you know, on your business instead of just working on all the to-do list items that come up. And Gene had a wonderful introduction for Rosie and me, and we really connected right away around this idea of, you know, you're a business owner, you're a mom, you are running a company, and how do you balance all of these things out? And how do you really think about integrating the business and the personal? And that is what I think our team at Bartlett is really skilled at, is understanding we don't have to have wealth to manage right now. I mean, we worked together for about a year and a half before Bartlett ever managed any
wealth. That's right. Yeah.
And
I specifically went looking for a woman financial advisor.
I love that.
I really wanted to have someone that I felt like I could relate to, who could relate to me and my concerns and understand, and we could have a better conversation as a result.
Yeah. I firmly believe in that.
Yeah.
I guess a question that I have then, so now we're meeting the team, you know what I mean? And I was brought in, I don't know at what point the foundation was brought in for the fund.
I think we had talked with Holly and her team about the donor advised fund.
Yes.
And we believe that we wanted to work specifically with community foundations to do that.
Because
we believe, you know, we have lived in Westchester for nearly 20 years and love the community, and our kids have grown up there and gone to Lakota schools and so forth. So we really believed that we wanted to, you know, help with the community as much as we could, but also learned about the Greater Cincinnati Foundation, which does tremendous work in the city of Cincinnati in particular, although they're regional as well. But we couldn't really decide. We couldn't make a decision. So we ended up splitting, you know, our
love that you did that, by the way.
In
I
half.
Use that as a really powerful conversation, I think, that you did, that, you know, there is a place, obviously, there are so many, there's over 700 different community foundations. And so a lot of people will do that. They will donate to maybe where they were born, but maybe they raised their family here and they'll split their funds. And so you were my first experience with that, as we are still young. Mm-hmm. Founded in 1999, but you do see that benchmark widely in community foundations. So I really love that you kind of set that standard. Is absolutely, you can do that, and it's two different regions. And I think that was very cool.
Yeah. I felt like we could also learn different kinds of things from the two different organizations.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad Holly set those meetings up with GCF and NCF staff. So I was grateful.
And I bring that up as another real benefit of pulling the team together, because I know you work with a great accounting team at Barnes Dennig, and Chad, who was the accountant along the way, was having these conversations, and we're talking to Emma and understanding, let's plan ahead and figure out what a tax liability might be. And when the deal came down to the final moments, it was right on the borderline of two calendar years, and we had to figure out how to make some gifts in one calendar year in case, you know, funds literally arrived in a bank account on 12/31. And it's very strategic, and you have to plan ahead. And if you wait till the last minute, Emma, to your point on how can you be expected to build trust and figure out a plan and execute a plan in such a compact period of time? And I think that, you know, Rosie, you and Chris and the entire TDA team did a really good job of planning ahead.
I am just so grateful for the awesome people that I've been able to work with and got to know during this process. And we absolutely couldn't have done what we did without this team. And it was so nice also to know that you all are such experts in your field, and we can just say, you guys handle it. Okay. Just tell us, you know, what we need to do in the end, you know, and we'll transfer the funds. And that was just such a relief. And I think that, a lot of business owners or founders and entrepreneurs, they don't necessarily have that attitude. They always believe that they can do it themselves, and they don't necessarily want to trust other people. And I certainly have found that in an older generation of our company ownership. And so I feel like, partly because of my exposure to, you know, having grown up here, because all the other owners are all immigrants, my exposure to and education and exposure to, you know, how you do things here helped me to have an increased level of trust so that I could say, hey, we need to bring in, yes, these folks are not cheap. Right. But it, you know, it's worth it. It is worth it because there is, it's very sophisticated. All these things that you have to keep in mind and the calendarization of it and the timing of it, all of that stuff. And of course, there are lots of things that you don't know. I had no idea what the timing of some of these things was going to be. Right. You know, you're very optimistic in the beginning. You're like, oh yeah, this will all close in 3 months and we'll be done. Bada bing, bada boom.
Right.
But it wasn't that way at all. Yeah. And so, you know, the fact that I had this trusted team around me that just made everything happen is such a relief.
But
so.
You worked, I mean, your tail off. I mean, throughout the process.
Selling a business is not easy for anyone.
No one can prepare you for it. I tell people selling a business, I can tell you it's going to be hard. I can tell you it's going to be a lot of work. I just helped one of my first clients when I started practicing law. He just sold his business yesterday. We closed.
Wow.
So it was very exciting. And actually, he sold to private equity. And his process was pretty smooth, too. And, you know, but to him, he's like, oh, my gosh. And I'm like, this was such a smooth deal. You know, but he said they told me it was going to be a lot of work. But it is hard for people to understand what that means. While, by the way, you still have to operate the business.
Yeah.
Because you don't know until you have that signed deal, until you have that closing, that this is really going to happen. So you've got to operate your business and keep your eyes on that. But then you have this huge distraction that a lot of your employees don't know about in regards to trying to get the deal done.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were really fortunate that you were able to kind of focus on the deal while other people focused on the operations.
That's right.
Can you educate us what it looks like after the deal is signed? Because obviously exits, and Emma, you're the specialist, so definitely correct me if I'm wrong. But I work with so many business owners that sell and then establish a family fund, which is amazing. But my question is, how long do you stay on? What is the typical time span?
It totally depends.
That's what
it depends what kind of buyer you have.
Right.
You know, private equity, they come in all flavors. They might have a C-suite team that they like to bring on. Like Rosie's deal is very interesting because there was a chemical executive, Tyler, who kind of helped put this deal together for their buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was always the understanding that Tyler then was going to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's going to be the CEO.
Exactly. Right? So that was always from the beginning. Sometimes, depending on the business, private equity will keep, you know, the C-suite in place. Strategics oftentimes have that leadership team. So then they're going to bring on a company and roll it in and may not need the CEO anymore because, listen, we've got our CEO out of Cincinnati. We don't need two CEOs. So it really depends on the flavor. I will say in my experience, founder-owned, family-owned, when they exit, it can be very hard becoming an employee. When you're used to calling the shots, you're used to have grown this baby, it's your baby, you give it over to somebody else and suddenly you're an employee.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone has the best intentions, but in those situations, I find that a year or so, I mean, people are kind of ready after that then to, you know, I mean, would you agree, Rosie?
Yeah, it's been a very emotional process for all of us and all of us on the ownership group, you know, doing it in different ways because some of them were less involved in the company when we closed anyway. And so, yeah, we're sort of transitioning out. I still have a role, a formal role at Tedia, and I handle the legal work and so forth. But I think, too, that just trying to adjust and say, you know, the group that bought us or that acquired us, they have their idea of what they want to do.
And they own the business.
And they
their
do.
Business.
Yeah. And from a very practical standpoint, they do. They own the business and they can make the decisions they want. But to, you know, to try and support that and to try and roll with it is indeed very challenging. And I'm still going through it and we'll see. I mean, it just continues to evolve
all
the time.
So basically we'll do another podcast in 3 or 4 months. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
One thing, Holly, I think it'd be helpful for you to educate our listeners. Rosie, your company had grown, but I find a lot of times business owners need help thinking about what kind of liquidity do I need to maintain my lifestyle? And they don't really think about that until they meet with a good advisor like you on an after-tax basis. Okay, what are we running through the business? I mean, what does this really look like? So I feel like if you could speak to that and how you may advise people on, okay, you're considering selling. Well, you know, what do we need to look at to determine what quality of life and what you need to get out of this deal and your business value?
I think that's a really great point that you bring up, Emma, because what you don't always recognize when you have a family business is just how many things do kind of go through the business and how there's just happens to be this nice cash flow that comes along with it. And then you have to get used to going back to a, I'll call it a quote unquote paycheck, but it comes from your portfolio instead of coming from a salary or a distribution, or the company pays for the cars and your cell phones and a vacation and a country club and these other things that are wonderful things to put through a company. So it does take a lot of careful planning. And what we also find with a lot of families is, Rosie, for your family, you were both very blessed that you and Chris and your mom and previously your dad were in the business. So it was truly a family business where everyone understood all the ins and outs. But in a lot of family businesses, there is one core spouse who is running the business day in, day out. And then there's a spouse who's running everything else, and they are the mastermind of the family. And you have to bring those two perspectives together to understand how they mesh together. And all too often, I think sometimes advisor teams can only focus on the person who is running the business without realizing the importance of having the person who's running the real family business, which is at home. And how do you make sure that that person understands the changes that will happen as you go through this business transition? So one activity that we do a lot of times right when we start with families is we developed a strategic wealth map to help people understand, what's the purpose of this? I mean, all of us go to work every day and we say, like, why are we going to work?
Don't we have fun?
Yeah, I mean, I do. Look, guys, we're doing this, you know.
So really digging into the purpose of your wealth, your value system, having conversations between couples, between families of what things do we want to accomplish with our wealth? And I think that for Rosie and your family was really the impetus to leaning into some of these sizable gifts to community foundations, was saying, we do want to give back. We're very fortunate to live in the community we live in. And that's where I want to spend more time going forward. And it helps us as we build the nuts and bolts of a plan to come back to those items. But what we do have to, there are nuts and bolts there, to your point, Emma, where we have to run the deep dive analysis and say, is this going to be the exit or is this an exit? Are you a serial entrepreneur where you're going to take this money and roll it into the next deal and find another opportunity, go be an executive someplace else? Or is this substantial enough that this is the major exit for you? Mm. And separating the two of those is really critical, mm-hmm. because I do think sometimes people forget just how much money goes to Uncle Sam when you sell a business. Yeah. And those are painful checks to write.
Yes,
absolutely.
Now, I will say that's a great PSA. We do accept S-Corp stock, so that can help, you know, give more without the bigger check to Uncle Sam. So
that's exactly right. And I think that's yet another reason why that is really complex. Mm-hmm. So yes, I know that we all, community foundations are great at advertising that. And however, they don't, it doesn't always get done that way because it's so complex and because you have to plan it in advance.
You do have to plan it in advance. We work with a third party, I will say that, for any business owners that are going to be listening to this on the business sale. It does need to be a certain dollar amount at least to go even through that process. But we work with a third party that that obviously they are more sophisticated when it comes to that.
That's how in advance do you have to plan? I'm just curious, like for people that may be interested in that option.
I would say 6 to 12 months in advance of a sale, because it has to be kind of signed, sealed, and delivered before you're getting LOIs.
Oh, wow.
And so if you have an LOI in hand, then the government's going to come and say, well, you can definitely sell this business for that, so I'm going to tax you at that. What you really want to do is transfer a portion of the ownership of the business over to a charitable entity before you have the letters of intent in hand and really setting a value. And, you know, if you are going to get a business valuation soon and you think it's going to be a lot higher than your last one, you might want to have those conversations even sooner. So I think that's why pulling
It just speaks again to like the team approach. The team, you know, yeah. We can't do that alone as the wealth advisor. The community foundation can't do it alone without recognizing the family wealth needs. And the attorney is really critical in that.
Yeah, the attorney is very critical. Yeah, definitely. For all of you badass ladies sitting here, I want to talk about how did you get here as women in your particular industries? Because I know it wasn't easy. So I kind of want to hear this story from each of you.
I would say, though, that for me, being part of a family business, it's sort of different. And I started out as a manager and waited a very, very, very long time before I got promoted. And that speaks to this idea within our company that just because I was the owner's kid, I was not entitled to, you know, to become president or whatever. And so, you know, I feel like I had to work very hard and prove myself. The chemical industry is a very male-dominated industry, and the company was very, very male-dominated for a long time. That is slowly changing because we're having these conscious conversations that we want that to change. And I see that it is changing, and I have a lot of hope for the future. But I think also I did not take anything for granted. I didn't assume anything that, you know, again, just because I'm the owner's kid, I get to do this, or I get to tell people what to do, or I get to have this role in the company, or not do what I don't feel like doing. I always felt like I owed it to the company. I had this feeling of responsibility and duty that I had to do what needed to be done for the company.
For me, and something I think that Rosie and I have in common is I was raised by a very strong single mom. My father's a recovering alcoholic. My parents were divorced when I was young, like I mentioned, and your dad is not, but your mom had to take on the business and find a way to carry it forward when your father passed away when you're mm-hmm, in high school. Mm-hmm. And my mom is a business owner, and I saw the hard work, and she was very strong. And my grandfather and a few of my uncles were in law. I was very close with my grandfather. He was a judge and he was elected. So I was very interested in politics and in law from an early age. And once I got to law school, I was, you know, really pulled to the business law aspect, helping business owners. Again, because both of my parents are business owners. My grandparents on the other side have businesses. I really grew up around business and I love helping business owners. I'm a lawyer, but really I'm an advisor. You know, I'm a trusted counselor. Yes, I do the law, but I think my value anymore is kind of strategically helping business owners. So I think it was that example of a strong, you know, female. And as hard as it can be, we all work a lot. And sometimes I think, you know, what is that going to mean for my children? You know, when I can't be at everything and I am working a lot. But it's funny because they will play work. And a colleague of mine said, the fact that your daughter for play goes, I'm going to work. To her, you know, it's fun. It's not like a bad thing. And I think to myself, you know, the example my mom set that I'm setting for her, that women in business is so important for the perspectives. Yes. And I totally understand. And it's such a hard job to be at home too. I mean, that is a full-time job. But I just think it's so important for our perspectives to be in the marketplace, mm-hmm. because diverse perspectives in general are important in our economy. So that's me.
From my perspective, I sort of haphazardly found my way into wealth management. I think a lot of people perceive that I had this mindset all along. And I, you know, like Rosie, went to Indiana University in Bloomington and knew that I wanted to be in the business school. My father was also a business owner. And down the line, looking back, I realized how much my mom was sort of the quiet helper behind the scenes. I didn't know that my parents had a double mortgage on our house that was based off of my mom's income so that my dad could start the business until I was much older. And knowing that my mom was working her career in public relations so that he could take the risk of starting a business is something that does, you know, not pass by easily on me today. It's something that I take very seriously as sitting in the role of president today, I feel tremendous responsibility to make sure that the families who work for Bartlett are well taken care of. And I know that that comes from many, many stories of my dad over the years. But anyway, I ended up at JP Morgan out of college because I figured it was the hardest thing to do. And
if I could figure out finance, then I could probably figure out most other things, and it would just work its way out over time.
I think that's a really great philosophy.
Yeah. Little did I know that I was saying yes to working in wealth management right before the 2008-2009
great timing, yes. If you can season it through that, yeah.
So it was a bit of a trial by fire, but through the way, I stuck it out because I realized that I had this understanding of numbers and understanding of markets, but I really understood the people. And you said you're a strategic counselor, and that's exactly what I envision my role as a wealth advisor is, being there for my clients during the amazing days when companies sell, but also being there when times are really, really hard. And honestly, sometimes those are the more gratifying experiences, but I think it's this unique combination for me of leaning into the finance and understanding the details, but also leaning into the people and recognizing that behind, every portfolio is a family or a nonprofit organization or an institution that really needs your team's help on that side. And that's where the power of that diverse perspective really comes into play. And I think you noted that earlier, Rosie. And for me, it's about setting that example of normalizing these conversations around wealth and normalizing conversations around families looking different. My husband's the one who stepped back and took on a part-time role and then built his own company, because we need to have flexibility in our family. And, we need to normalize those conversations where if my son wants to be the one who stays home and raises the kids, like, that's amazing. And if my daughter wants to be that one, that's amazing. Like, go do what you want to do to be really happy.
I work with people like that all the time in philanthropy that chose not to have families as well. But just, I think female empowerment on the finance aspect is really important. Can you just dive into that a little bit, Holly?
Yeah. So what I take away from a lot of these conversations is how many times we've talked about risk and how we normalize different parts of risk. And when I think about it, we as women are sometimes told that we're not great investors, or we are not, we're too risk averse. And at Bartlett, when we looked into the details, we really dug into it and we said, like, we don't think that's true.
You and I have talked about this.
It's not true.
I'm much more risk tolerant than my husband. Yeah. I mean, he's much more conservative. I'm much more willing to take risks with finances.
So what it boils down to, though, is also, as a lawyer especially, you are a question asker. You ask a lot of great questions. You find the data. You get into it. You talk to people about it. And that's what I want to really bring to the table for women across our region and really everywhere, is this idea of you deserve to ask the deeper questions. You deserve to learn more about the financial aspects of your wealth. And you deserve to have a reason why, and just keep asking those deep questions and keep exploring. And I think that we'd be in a really great place.
I'm curious, when you're having these conversations with women, do they ask questions that are somehow qualitatively different than the questions that men ask? Do they have a different perspective that you can generalize about?
I would say, in general, it's less about counting the chips. It's less about saying, hey, I found this hot new stock, when you're out on the golf course, which is a huge generalization. but I'll say my book club doesn't typically talk about stocks. Now, we do now, because I'm in the book club and I force my friends to talk about their 401ks. But what I find is that my female clients love to connect it to the deeper purpose of their wealth. And my male clients do too, because that's just what we're good at Bartlett. And I find that that is a common thread for a lot of my clients. But I do find that it's more fun to talk about it when we say, hey, Park and Carter are getting ready for college. What do you envision for them? How do you want to help them out? Or, you're getting ready to give these gifts to community foundations. What things are you passionate about? And for instance, Rosie, I know you've done so much good work with the Jeanette Rankin Foundation and helping women who are going back to school. And, when I hear you talk about that and how your face lights up when you talk about your fundraising events, like, that's exciting.
But how can we as women, something that I've been toiling with is how I'd really love in my spare time to come up with content to help educate women business owners, because so many women business owners don't understand finance well, don't understand ever how what do I do with this asset? You know, when is it time to exit? What are my options? You know, maybe we don't exit. Maybe we recap. Maybe we try to go get some debt. Maybe we get investors. And there are so many women who probably, you know, aren't as exposed to resources like men. They're not on the golf course. So, you know, how can we as women really be having more of those conversations and giving more access? I mean, Holly and I have talked for years, and we're going to make it happen, about getting a group together, you know, kind of to talk just about, there's an investment club that was started a long time ago by some women leaders in Cincinnati for women. But I think that that needs to happen across our country, because 100%. Those resources are needed in general, but especially for women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that is just a common thread, you know, among all women. And I mean, we started a local group in Cincinnati called Cocktails, Careers, and Conversations because of this issue. You know, it's just like these conversations, A, need to be had. And I think also it can be learned. You should never be afraid of anything. If it scares you, then jump in, figure it out, and, you know, you'll have the knowledge. You need to act and do, in my experience, you know what I mean? And you'll learn it. You did that with JP Morgan. You were like, hey, listen, I can learn this. I'm sure we've all done that in our fields. And so it's the courage to jump in, dive in. We encourage other women to do that. And I think you also support and build up other women, like, hey, you
absolutely
can do this. Yes. You can do this. And to me, that's just so important that we do that.
Well, Holly, getting back to the idea of taking time away from your business to explore these other things, I think a lot of business owners they feel like they have to be stuck to their business and working in the business all the time, and that somehow taking time away from the business is bad for the business. But that's actually the opposite of the truth.
I want to talk about one fun question, because I feel like we're all so type A, frankly, in our own right. I want to ask you all, yeah, very much so. I want to ask you all, and we'll shake it up here with Emma. What is your morning routine like? Like your daily morning routine, Monday through Friday?
This is not very exciting for a type A person.
Oh.
But I wake up at 5 a.m. almost every day, including on the weekends, unfortunately. Even if I...
It's like really early in the morning. I'd be like,
I'm a very early riser, and I have to go be active. Like, I need to go run. I need to go Peloton. I need to go do my Pilates. It's not because I'm obsessed with the fitness, which I do like the fitness. It's really mental health. I love being outside. So I love running. I love getting fresh air. I love being with friends. I oftentimes will run with friends in the morning. So it's social. It's a way for me to start my day that's frankly for me. Like, it is an hour for me. And I, you know, people are like, how do you get it in? Well, if you're only sleeping 6.5 hours, you know, you get up at 5 and you get it in. But that's how I start my day. And I need to do that. I mean, I have a lot of energy. It needs to get burned off a little bit before I go into my day, or else I'm just like a rabid beast.
Yes. I actually can really, like, that is spot on almost my week and same energy type. So what about you, Holly?
Just a fair warning. If Emma ever asks you to go on a walking meeting, wear real tennis shoes and something that you can, you know, be active.
Oh my God.
I took her sister on a walking meeting with me.
I have to say this. Lindsay, my sister, went on a walking meeting. She's with Oswald Construction, a female in the construction industry. And she said, wow, Emma, I went on a walk with her, but it was not really like a walk. I was out of breath. And she's like, all right, should we do another lap? And she's like, like dying. And I'm laughing because Lindsay, by the way, she is not very like Lindsay, don't listen to this. She is not very exercise. She doesn't love exercise. Sister Dick, I love
her. She's serious.
Amazing.
The walking meetings are great.
I mean, hey, I'm in. But you know what she said to me when she left that? Wow, I felt like I was walking with you, because it was like all this energy and the same kind of comments, which, by the way, I think you and I are like on after childbirth. I couldn't even make it 2 weeks before I was back at the office. I
right.
was like, I need to be back like tomorrow. I feel like a caged lion, and I need, like, this is unfair. Why 6 weeks?
But I want to say this for women listening, and I tell my colleagues this, men and women. I was the same way. I mean, I was managing even out. But that's me. I do not expect that of my colleagues.
I know.
And so I know you probably don't either, but I like to tell people that. I'm like, I email a lot because that's just me. Like, you know, but I think it's important to set tones for also for the people that we work with, because Absolutely. We are all high achievers.
Yes.
But I always like to tell people, and I like to say to other people, this is not my expectation. You don't have to get it to me tonight. Go home and have dinner with your family. Just because I've got like five screws loose up here doesn't mean that you also have to be, you know.
I love that.
I mean, and yeah. I think we should all remember that, because we all are so high.
We should. We are all so, you know, high energy. And my sister actually boundary sets with me on purpose for that reason. So I love that. Bring that up. Go ahead, Holly, on your mornings.
For the record, I enjoyed my full 12 weeks of maternity leave. So much so that when I returned to Bartlett, we figured out a way to make sure that every employee gets a full 12 weeks of maternity leave, and also a parental leave policy, so paternity leave as well, because it was really enjoyable. So my mornings are not quite as active as Emma's, but I really love yoga. So I found yoga when I was living in Chicago working for the bank during a financial crisis, and realized I needed something to ground me and something to make me stand up out of my desk. So I do yoga in the mornings before the family is awake. And
like
my husband video. Does
do you
ask,
do it at home?
I do it at home, and I do it off of the Gaia app, and I love it. And my husband always says, like, do you have to wake up so early? And I say, yes, because this is my me time. And he knows the days when I sleep in, because I'm not as happy when the rest of the family wakes up.
Well, I will say that I'm a little older than all of y'all. And and perimenopause is starting to kick in. And I feel more fatigued and tired than I ever remember being. And we women don't talk enough about menopause and perimenopause.
Yes. I'm so happy
that's
to read
another
that.
Topic yes. potentially for what
I
gives.
Have a really yes. good person that Carolyn Michelli, who's sorry Carolyn, I know you don't, I don't think you would mind, she's the investor she's the investor relations head at Scripps.
Yeah.
And she's like a SVP, EVP there. She's amazing. But she was saying, telling me this issue, you know, that women don't talk about this issue
Agreed.
Enough.
Right.
They don't.
And we need to, because that's something else that we.
That's right. Because there are all these changes going on
that,
in your body and in your mind. And you're like, am I going crazy? Am I going insane? Like, what is wrong with me? And because there's no one to normalize these, what you're going through, you do feel like you're experiencing something and you're unhappy about it, but you don't know how to deal with it because you don't know how to put it in context. Mm-hmm. And so I will say that, I'm a lot more tired and I need a lot more sleep than I used to. That said, when I do get up, I a little meditation, a little yoga, like those, but my mornings are very laid back compared to y'all's.
Yeah. I hope one day that I've exited a business and maybe I feel like,
I don't know. I wonder where we're going to be as we age, because I'm going to have a heart attack at like 5 a.m. I'm like at 5 a.m., you know, you go downstairs, you get your workout in, and I'm like, oh, now I'm having coffee, and now I'm firing off like 50 emails. And hey, I'm working from the gym on Saturday, which is my time to drink more coffee and fire off emails. And it's like, it's a little high strung. So.
Yeah.
What's yours? You're always up early.
I'm always up early. So I get up early. I get up an hour before the kids. I go to the basement. I get my workout in. I start my coffee when I go down to the basement. I come up midway through my workout to start drinking it during my workout.
Really?
Yes, because I have to have 2 to 3 cups. It's a problem. And then I'm super high strung after that, you know, because you've got the dopamine from the workout and all the coffee.
Plus the caffeine, yeah.
And,
oh, my God.
Yeah, and I usually fire off some emails. Our producer has been at the receiving end of my morning emails, and I'm sorry about that. But and then I get the kids, you know, into the school routine, and then I'm in the office. So, yeah, that's my – I have to work out. If I don't work out, I'm a total mess.
Well, when you have young kids, as all of you do, you have to be on the ball. I mean, you have to be, like, super – organized,
super
or else
mom,
you can't get things
super
done.
Schedule, checklists. So anyway, well, ladies, I feel like I could literally just talk to you all day. We have so many topics that we could cover. So the world is ending like tomorrow. And
tomorrow? Because I'm an attorney, so I'm going to, okay. I need the parameters. Okay.
Tomorrow, 5:55 a.m.
Okay.
You might get your workout in if you're lucky. What are you bringing in your bug out bag? A bug out bag is the bag you take with you if the world is ending.
I'm dead tomorrow.
Oh,
what do I
my
need?
God. I mean, listen, the world, you might survive. What's in your bug out bag?
You said the world's ending.
Well, oh my goodness. Okay,
I know
ready
I
go.
Can't do this. I'm too rational.
I feel like a flashlight and a ham.
Oh, the ham, a ham.
If I have my kids protein with me, I definitely need their like Nine-Nights and their bunnies that they sleep with, and then a giant bag of goldfish and a giant bag of fruit snacks.
Oh, I love that. Just throw fruit snacks at them.
Running shoes. You? I gotta be outside. I gotta be like, if I have my running shoes, I can be anywhere.
Yeah, you can run away from whatever.
Yeah, that's right. You've got it.
That's got to run. I travel.
You have to pick up the pace here. You can't do the marathon running.
Would be the woman who outruns Armageddon.
I mean, that's all I need.
Into the sunset. That's all I need. I love it. For our women, our young women and women listening today, what do you guys have as advice that you feel like you should give? And on the business front, or just as females trying to make their way in the world?
I would say maintain your integrity and be true to yourself. I think so often we are lulled into this idea that we have to fit in. And yes, you do have to fit in terms of being a good team player and that kind of thing. But you want to be your genuine self, because the longer you hide that, the more it just, you know, aches to come out. And it's going to come out at some point. And you want to, you know, give that gift to the world. You want to be your genuine self, to share your truth and your authenticity with your team, with your coworkers, with the world.
Very sage advice.
No, I love that. Like, do it your way, because we all are going to have advice on how we did it or how other people have done it. But I think, to your point, Rosie, you really have to figure out what's going to work best for you. And I think something that I've learned, the older I've gotten, is learn. Like, stay open to learning. That's what I love so much about what I get to do. I get to learn every day something new. With my clients, on problems I'm working on, you know, stay open to learning, stay curious, and, you know, just keep growing.
Be yourself and ask for help. I think we
and help others.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Definitely.
Help others. Should we talk about give back give before back. We go?
What gives?
Hour of give back?
I know. No, I think, you know, this is a really good question, I will say, Emma. And frankly, one that I, as of late, am honestly perplexed by sometimes in certain circles. It's philanthropy, right? And giving back. And we are also aware of the importance of either volunteering or giving assets or both. And so I think that that is a really valid question today is, you know, for you, Rosie, and I want all of us to talk on this topic, you know, why give? Why did you feel you didn't have to give through community foundations? You did. And what's your why? You know, why do you feel connected to helping others?
I think that I have benefited so much because my parents worked so very hard to create a good life for my sister and me, for the whole family. And education was always an incredibly important part of that. They came here to this country to get their education. And it was based on that that they were able to build the business. And there was always no question that my sister and I would go to college. And because of that, we have been able to create great, wonderful, meet our husbands, for one thing, and have a wonderful life as a result, partly of our education. And I also feel that women who are often prevented from getting their educations because of tough decisions that they've had to make, circumstances that they find themselves in, and a lack of support from the people around them. So when you have an education, you can dramatically increase your own income earning potential, and you provide a wonderful example to those around you that you can work hard, get this degree, and you can make a good living and provide a good, stable, healthy household living for your family.
Erin, I don't want to turn this on you and Holly, but I'm curious, you know, I'm involved in several nonprofits, and it's my understanding that our generation, or the younger generation, isn't it as philanthropic? I mean, they're not giving as much. You know, when I talk to people at the art, I don't know if you guys see that as well, but yeah.
Yes, we are. And that is statistically true at this point. Of course, you know, I still have hope in the millennial and younger generations that will shift and that will change. I think really what I hear always is a common thread to people that give back is like that culture of, my parents did X, Y, Z, you know, it was modeled to me, my mother, you know, whoever it was that was involved in giving back, philanthropy, volunteer activities. that you also just follow in those footsteps. It doesn't always have to be that way. It could be maybe through Cincinnati Works downtown, right? You're given an opportunity for a second chance in your life, and you want to give back because you got involved with that nonprofit. That can happen too. But to me, I think it is really just somebody set the example, was a mentor on giving back. For me, that was my mother. She actually wrote the articles of incorporation for the Community Foundation of Westchester Liberty when it was founded. Wow. Obviously now Northern Cincinnati Very Foundation. Cool. And she was on the board at Cincinnati Works. She was just always doing everything, giving time, talent, and treasure. She sat on many boards. And so we were just raised that, like, you know, she started the school gala at Mount Notre Dame, and hey, we're going to sell all these raffle tickets and we're going to do all these things. And it was a learned behavior. And so now we step in those same, you know, footprints and follow her footsteps to kind of carry the torch. And I find a lot of times maybe our generation wasn't educated in that regard that they should do that. I don't know. I was raised that way, so it's hard for me to empathize with not giving because it's just in my blood.
I think what's also interesting about our generation is we just have a lot of demands on our time and on our resources and on expectations. And so it's about welcoming people into this way of how do you introduce giving in a way that is digestible for them and attainable, and volunteering and being on boards, because it can all seem like something that isn't for me, and I'm not really welcome there. And I think we have to change that dialogue.
Yeah, I think we do have to change that dialogue. I think everyone is welcome to have a seat at that table, like you said, on a board.
I can tell everyone's welcome to write a check.
Yes, yes. I'll take your money. That is 100% valid. But, you know, I think, too, people fall in love with what they're involved in. You know what I mean?
You have to find a passion.
You have to find the passion. And if you have this sweat equity in some nonprofit cause, and yes, hey, we would love to hold, you know, your S Corp stock, you know, that you transferred to the Northern Cincinnati Foundation. But at the end of the day, our whole mission is about connecting people to their causes and helping support their causes. And I love that. I love that Rosie's cause, one of her main causes to give back, was the Jeanette Rankin Foundation. I was like, oh my gosh, I haven't heard of this. And then I'm looking it up. And so we're always learning about different nonprofits. There are so many wonderful ones, you know, in the region, nationally, internationally, that that local organizations or national organizations are partnering with abroad. So I just think it's important, you know, you get involved, you do it, even if you can't give monetarily. Like, they still need help. They still need thinkers for the future on how are they going to continue that pipeline for their cause, their mission. And it's really important work. So if you have a cause, get involved.
And I think something that's amazing, Erin, that you do at the foundation that probably sets you apart from others is you're such a good connector. So you're not only being a good steward of the money that people invest with you, but you also then support their networking growth and how can I help your business? I mean, that is a huge distinction, I'm sure, among other directors of foundations. I mean, you go above and beyond.
Yeah, I do. And I think it's all about people, relationships. I mean, at the foundation, we want to grow because the more we grow, the more we can give. And so to me, it's like, yes, you know, you're charitable, you're giving back. I'm going to help refer individuals to you as well. Because I just think it's important, right? Our region is a wonderful region. It's like this small city. And in a way, look, we're all interconnected. And we didn't know that ahead of this podcast. So,
and I love that I just said, Holly, come meet us for happy hour. And then it was like, I know Holly, she should join. And I'm like, this is amazing.
Let's have her on the podcast. We're all sitting down.
But I think a way to end it, and to your point, is a rising tide rises all, whatever it rises all ships. You know what I mean? And I truly believe that the more we can help each other without any expectation back.
Yeah. I agree.
Thing though is that a lot of people don't necessarily, to your point, Holly, don't necessarily see themselves as being givers. I mean, they're like, I don't have a lot of assets. I don't have a lot of money to give. Why, you know, I can't make a difference. But once you find a cause that you're passionate about and you start to spend some time there and you learn more about it, you I think the giving just comes automatically, and you're capable of giving more than you think.
Yeah,
and if you give a pledge over, you know, you can
pledge money over a period of time and give a small chunk of that, you know, every year for 5 years or 10 years or however long. But I think people need to believe that they have the potential to give.
And get that good feeling. I think that's something that's so gratifying is when you see your gift play out, like how you saw the people, you know, that you helped with your grant. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's got to be the best feeling in the world.
It definitely is.
Well, thank you all, ladies, for joining us on What Gives today. It's been an absolute pleasure. The future starts
right now. To learn more about how to expand your philanthropy, please reach out to the Northern Cincinnati Foundation. What Gives is produced and distributed by King Hightower Strategies.